11.
The rain waited until Monday, Dave said. When the business about the cigarettes still wouldn't quit nagging him, wouldn't quit even though he was almost a year and a half downriver from that part of his life, he called me on the telephone and explained to me that he had an idea that maybe, just maybe, the pack of cigarettes John Doe had been carrying around hadn't come from the state of Maine. If not, the stamp on the bottom would show where they had come from. He voiced his doubts about whether John Doe was a smoker at all, but said the tax stamp might be a clue, even if he wasn't. I agreed with him, but was curious as to why he'd called me. He said he couldn't think of anyone else who still might be interested at that late date. He was right, I was still interested. Vince, too. And he turned out to be right about the stamp as well. Now, I am not a smoker myself, and never have been, which is probably one of the reasons I've attained the great age of 65 in such beautiful shape. Vince grunted and waved a hand at him. Dave continued, unperturbed. So I made a little trip down street to Bayside News and asked if I could examine a package of cigarettes. My request was granted, and I observed that there was indeed an ink stamp on the bottom, not a postage-type stamp. I then made a call to the Attorney General's office and spoke to a fellow named Murray in a department called Evidence Storage and Filing. I was as diplomatic as I could possibly be, Stephanie, because at that time those two dumbbell detectives would still have been on active duty. And they'd overlooked a potentially valuable clue, hadn't they, Steph asked. One that could have narrowed the search for John Doe down to one single state, and it was practically staring them in the face.
Yep, Vince said. And no way could they blame their intern, either, because they'd specifically told him to keep his nose out of the evidence bag. Plus, by the time it became clear that he'd disobeyed them,
he was beyond their reach, she finished.
You said it, Dave agreed. But they wouldn't have gotten much of a scolding in any case. Remember, they had an actual murder investigation going over in Tinoch. Manslaughter, two folks burned to death, and John Doe was just a choking victim.
Still, Stephanie looked doubtful.
Still dumb, and you needn't be too polite to say it. You're among friends, Dave told her with a grin. But the Islander had no interest in making trouble for those two detectives. I made that clear to Murray, and I also made it clear that this wasn't a criminal matter. All I was doing was trying to find out who the poor fellow was, because someplace there were very likely people missing him and wanting to know what had befallen him. Murray said he'd have to get back to me on that, which I kind of expected. But I still had a bad afternoon, wondering if maybe I should have played my cards a little different. I could have, you know, I could have had Doc Robinson make the call to Augusta, maybe even talked Cathcart into doing it. But the idea of using either of them as a cat's paw kind of went against my grain. I suppose it's canny, but I really do believe that in 9 cases out of 10, honesty is the best policy. I was just worried this one might turn out to be the 10th. In the end, though, it came out all right. Murray called me back just after I'd made up my mind he wasn't Gunter and had started pulling on my jacket to go home for the day. Isn't that the way things like that usually go? A watched pot never boils, Vince said. My gosh, that's like poetry. Give me a pad and pencil so I can write it down, Dave said, grinning more widely than ever.
The grin did more than take years off his face. It knocked them flying, and she could see the boy he had been. Then he grew serious once more, and the boy disappeared again.
In big cities, evidence gets lost all the time, I understand. But I guess Augusta's not that big yet, even if it is the state capital. Sergeant Murray had no trouble whatsoever finding the evidence bag with Paul Devane's signature on the possession slip. He said he had it 10 minutes after we got done talking. The rest of the time that went by, he was trying to get permission from the right person to let me know what was inside it, which he finally did. The cigarettes were Winston's, and the stamp on the bottom was just the way Paul Devane remembered. a regular little stick-on type that said, Colorado, in tiny Dak letters. Murray said he'd be turning the information over to the Attorney General's office, and they'd appreciate knowing in advance of publication if we got anywhere in identifying the Colorado Kid. That's what he called him, so I guess you could say it was Sergeant Murray in the AG's Evidence Storage and Filing Department who coined the phrase. He also said he hoped that if we did have any luck identifying the guy, that we'd note in our story that the AG's office had been helpful. You know, I thought that was sorta sweet.
Stephanie leaned forward, eyes shining, totally absorbed. So what did you do next? How did you proceed? Dave opened his mouth to reply, but Vince put a hand on the managing editor's burly shoulder to stop him before he could.
How do you think we proceeded, dear?
School is in, she asked.
Tis, he said.
And because she saw by his eyes and the set of his mouth, more by the latter, that he was absolutely in earnest, she thought carefully before replying. You made copies of the sleeping ID?
Yeah, we did.
And then, you sent it with clippings to how many Colorado papers? He smiled at her, nodded, gave her a thumbs up.
78, Ms. McCann. And I don't know about Dave, but I was amazed at how cheap it had become to send out such a number of duplications, even back in 1981. Why, it couldn't have come to $100 total out-of-pocket expense, even with the postage. And of course, we wrote it all off to the business, said Dave, who doubled as the Islander's bookkeeper. Every penny, as we had every right to do.
How many of them ran it?
Every frickin' one,
Vince said, and fetched his narrow thigh a vicious slap.
Even the Denver Post and the Rocky Mountain News. Because then there was only one peculiar thing about it and a beautiful through line, don't you see?
Stephanie nodded. Simple and beautiful, she did see. Vince nodded back, absolutely beaming.
Unknown man, maybe from Colorado, found on an island beach in Maine 2,000 miles away. No mention of the stake stuffed halfway down his gullet. No mention of the coat that might have gotten off Jimmy Jesus knows where, or might not have been there at all. No mention of the Russian coin in his pocket. Just the Colorado Kid, your basic, unexplained mystery. And so sure, they all ran it, even the free ones that are mostly coupons. And 2 days after the Boulder newspaper ran it near the end of October 1981, Dave said, I got a call from a woman named Alla Cogan. She lived in Nederland, a little way up in the mountains from Boulder, and her husband had disappeared in April of the previous year, leaving her and a son who had been 6 months old at the time of his disappearance. She said his name was James, and although she had no idea what he could possibly have been doing on an island off the coast of Maine, the photograph in the camera looked a great deal like her husband. A great deal indeed. He paused. I guess she knew it was more than just a passing resemblance, because she got about that far and then began to cry.
12. Stephanie asked Dave to spell Mrs. Cogan's first name. In Dave Bowie's thick Maine accent, all she was hearing was a bunch of A sounds with an L in the middle. He did so, then said,
She didn't have his fingerprints, a cast nut, Paul left behind thing, but she was able to give me the name of the dentist they used, and...
Wait, Stephanie said, putting her hand up like a traffic cop. This man Cogan, what did he do for a living?
He was a commercial artist in a Denver advertising agency, Vince said. I've seen some of his work since. I'd have to say he was a pretty good one. He was never going to go nationwide, but if you wanted a quick picture for an advertising circular that showed a woman holding a roll of toilet tissue up like she just got herself a prize trout, Cogan was your man. He commuted to Denver twice a week on Tuesdays and Wednesdays for meetings and product conferences. Rest of the time, he worked at home.
She switched her gaze back to Dave. The dentist spoke to Cathcart, the medical examiner. Is that right?
You're hitting on all cylinders, Steph. Cathcart didn't have any x-rays of the kid's dental work. He wasn't set up for that, so no reason to send the cops out to County Memorial where dental x-rays could have been taken. But he noted all the fillings, plus the two crowns. Everything matched. He then went on ahead and sent copies of the dead man's fingerprints to the Nederland police, who got a tech from the Denver PD to go out to the Cogan residence and dust James Cogan's home office for prints. Mrs. Cogan, Alla, told the fingerprint man he wouldn't find anything, that she'd cleaned the whole works from stem to stern when she'd finally admitted to herself that her Jim wouldn't come back, that he'd either left her, which she could hardly believe, or that something awful had happened to him, which she was coming to believe. The fingerprint man said that if Cogan had spent a significant amount of time in the room that had been his study, there would still be prints.
Dave paused and sighed, ran a hand through what remained of his hair.
There were, and we knew for sure who John Doe, also known as the Colorado Kid, really was. James Cogan, age 42, of Nederland, Colorado, married to Alla Cogan, father of Michael Cogan, age 6 months at the time of his father's disappearance, age going on 2 years at the time of his father's identification.
Vince stood up and stretched with his fisted hands in the small of his back.
What you say? We go inside, people. It's commencing to get a tiny bit chilly out here, and there's a little more to tell.
13. They each took a turn at the restroom hidden in an alcove behind the old offset press that they no longer used. The paper was now printed in Ellsworth, and had been since 02. While Dave took his turn, Stephanie put on the Mr. Coffee. If the story that was not a story went on another hour or so, and she had the feeling it might, they'd all be glad of a cup. When they were reconvened, Dave sniffed in the direction of the little kitchenette and nodded approvingly.
I like a woman who hasn't decided the kitchen's a place of slavery just because she works for a living.
I feel absolutely the same way about a man, Stephanie said. And when he laughed and nodded, she had gotten off another good one, two in one afternoon, a record, she tilted her own head toward the huge old press. That thing looks like a place of slavery to me, she said.
It looks worse than it ever was, Vince said. But the one before it was a horror. That one'd take your arm off if you weren't careful and make a damn good snatch at it even if you were. Now, where were we?
With the woman who just found out she was a widow, Stephanie said. I presume she came to get the body?
Yep, Dave said.
And did one of you fetch her here from the airport in Bangor?
What do you think, dear?
It wasn't a question Stephanie had to mull over for very long. By late October or early November of 1981, the Colorado Kid would have been very old business to the state of Maine authorities. And, as a choking victim, he had been very minor business to begin with. Just an unidentified dead body, really. Of course you did. You two were really the only friends she had in the state of Maine. This idea had the odd effect of making her realize that Arla Cogan had been, and somewhere almost certainly still was, a real person. And not just a chess piece in an Agatha Christie whodunit or an episode of murder she wrote.
I went, Vince said, speaking softly.
He sat forward in his chair, looking at his hands, which were clasped in a driftwood gnarl below his knees.
She wasn't what I expected, either. I had a picture built in my head, one based on a wrong idea. I should have known better. I've been in the newspaper business 65 years, as long as my partner in crime there has been alive, and he's no longer the gay blade he thinks he is. And in that length of time, I've seen my share of dead bodies. Most of them would put all that romantic poetry stuff, I saw a maiden fair and still, out of your head in damn short order.
Dead bodies are ugly things indeed, by and large. Many hardly look human at all anymore. But that wasn't true of the Colorado kid. He looked almost good enough to be the subject of one of those romantic poems by Mr. Poe. I photographed him before the autopsy, of course. You have to remember that. And if you stared at the finished portrait for more than a second or two, he still looked deader than hell, at least me he did. But yes, there was something kind of handsome about him, just the same, with his ashy cheeks and pale lips and that little touch of lavender on his eyelids.
Brr, Stephanie said, but she sort of knew what Vince was saying, and yes, it was a poem by Poe it called to mind. The one about the lost Lenore.
Yeah, sounds like true love to me, Dave said, and got up to pour the coffee.
14. Vince Teague dumped what looked to Stephanie like half a carton of half and half into his, then went on. He did so with a rather rueful smile.
All I'm trying to say is that I sort of expected a pale and dark-haired beauty. What I got was a chubby redhead with lots of freckles. I never doubted her grief and worry for a minute, but I should guess she was one of those who eats rather than fasts when the rats gnaw at her nerves. Her folks had come from Omaha or Des Moines or somewhere to watch out for the baby. And I'll never forget how lost and somehow alone she looked when she came out of the jetway, holding her little carry-on bag not by her side, but up to her pouter pigeon bosom. She wasn't a bit what I expected, not the lost Lenore.
Stephanie jumped and thought, maybe now the telepathy goes three ways.
But I knew who she was right away. I waved, and she came to me and said, Mr. Teague. And when I said, yes, that's who I was, she put down her bag and hugged me and said, thank you for coming to meet me. Thank you for everything. I can't believe it's him, but when I look at the picture, I know it is. It's a good long drive down here. No one knows that better than you, Steph. We had lots of time to talk. The first thing she asked me was if I had any idea what Jim was doing on the coast of Maine. I told her I did not. And she asked me if he'd registered at a local motel on the Wednesday night. He broke off and looked at Dave. Am I right? Wednesday night?
Dave nodded.
It would have been a Wednesday night, she asked about, because it was a Thursday morning Johnny and Nancy found him on. 25th of April, 1980.
You just know that, Stephanie marveled. Dave shrugged.
Stuff like that sticks in my head, he told her. And then I'll forget the loaf of bread I meant to bring home and have to go out in the rain and get it.
Stephanie turned back to Vince. Surely he didn't register at a motel the night before he was found, or you guys wouldn't have spent so long calling him John Doe. You might have known him by some other alias, but no one registers at a motel under that name. He was nodding long before she finished.
Dave and I spent 3 or 4 weeks after the Colorado kid was found, in our spare time, of course, canvassing motels in what Mr. Yates would have called a widening gyre, with Moose Lookout Island at the center. It would have been damn near impossible during the summer season, when there's 400 motels, inns, cabins, bed and breakfasts, and assorted rooms to rent, all competing for trade within a half-day's drive of the Tinnock Ferry. It wasn't anything but a part-time job in April, because 70% of them are shut down from Thanksgiving to Memorial Day. We showed that picture everywhere, Steffi.
No joy?
Not a bit of it, Dave confirmed.
She turned to Vince. What did she say when you told her that?
Nothing. She was flummoxed.
He paused.
Cried a little.
Of course she did, poor thing, Dave said.
And what did you do? Stephanie asked, all of her attention still fixed on Vince.
My job, he said with no hesitation.
Because you're the one who always has to know, she said. His bushy, tangled eyebrows went up.
You think so?
Yes, she said, I do. And she looked at Dave for confirmation.
I think she nailed you there, Pad, Dave said.
Question is it your job, Steffi?
Vince asked with a crooked smile.
I think it is.
Sure, she said almost carelessly. She had known this for weeks now, although if anyone had asked her before coming to the Islander, she would have laughed at the idea of deciding for sure on a life's work based on such an obscure posting. The Stephanie McCann who had almost decided on going to New Jersey instead of to Moose Lookout off the coast of Maine now seemed like another person to her, a flatlander. What did she tell you? What did she know?
Vince said, just enough to make a strange story even stranger.
Tell me.
All right, but fair warning. This is where the through line ends.
Stephanie didn't hesitate. Tell me anyway. 15.
Jim Colgan went to work at Mountain Outlook Advertising in Denver on Wednesday, April the 23rd, 1980, just like any other Wednesday, Vince said. That's what she told me. He had a portfolio of drawings he'd been working on for Sunset Chevrolet, one of the big local car companies that did a ton of print advertising with Mountain Outlook, a very valuable client. Colgan had been one of four artists on the Sunset Chevrolet account for the last 3 years, she said, and she was positive the company was happy with Jim's work, and the feeling was mutual. Jim liked working on the account. She said his specialty was what he called holy shit women. When I asked her what that was, she smiled and said they were pretty ladies with wide eyes and open mouths, and usually with their hands clapped to their cheeks. The drawings were supposed to say, holy shit, what a buy I got at Sunset Chevrolet.
Stephanie laughed. She had seen such drawings, usually in free advertising circulars at the Shop and Save across the reach in Tinhock. Vince was nodding.
Anna was a fair shake of an artist herself, only with words. What she showed me was a very decent man, loved his wife, his baby, and his work.
Sometimes loving eyes don't see what they don't want to see, Stephanie remarked.
Young but cynical, Dave cried, not without relish. Well, but she's got a point, Vince said. Only thing is, 16 months is usually long enough to put aside the rose-colored glasses. If there had been something going on, discontent with the job or maybe a little honey on the side would seem the most likely, I think she would have found sign of it, or at least caught a whiff of it, unless the man was almighty, almighty careful, because during that 16 months she talked to everyone he knew, most of them twice, and they all told her the same thing. He liked his job, he loved his wife, and he absolutely idolized his baby son. She kept coming back to that. He never would have left Michael, she said. I know that, Mr. Teague. I know it in my soul.
Vince shrugged as if to say, so sue me.
I believed her.
And he wasn't tired of his job, Stephanie asked? Had no desire to move on?
She said not. Said he loved their place up in the mountains. Even had a sign over the front door that said Hernando's Hideaway. And she talked to one of the artists he worked with on the Sunset Chevrolet account. A fellow Colgan had worked with for years. Dave, do you recall the name?
Judge Rankin or Judge Franklin, Dave said.
Cannot recall which right off the top of my head. Don't let it get you down, old-timer, Vince said. Even Willie Mays dropped a pop-up from time to time, I guess, especially toward the end of his career.
Dave stuck out his tongue. Vince nodded as if such childishness was exactly what he'd come to expect of his managing editor, then took up the thread of his story once more.
Judge the artist, be he Rankin or Franklin, told Alla that Jim had pretty much reached the top end of that which his talent was capable, and he was one of the fortunate people who not only knew his limitations, but was content with them. He said Jim's remaining ambition was to someday head Mountain Outlook's art department. And given that ambition,
cutting and running for the New England coast in the spur of the moment is just about the last thing he would have done.
But she thought that's what he did do, Stephanie said. Isn't it? Vince put his coffee cup down and ran his hands through his fluff of white hair, which was already fairly crazy.
Alec Cogan's like all of us, he said. A prisoner of the evidence. James Cogan left his home at 6:35 a.m. on that Wednesday to make the drive to Denver by way of the Boulder Turnpike. The only luggage he had was that portfolio I mentioned. He was wearing a gray suit, a white shirt, a red tie, and a gray overcoat. Oh, and black loafers on his feet.
No green jacket? Stephanie asked.
No green jacket, Dave agreed. But the gray slacks, white shirt, and black loafers was almost certainly what he was wearing when Johnny and Nancy found him sitting dead on the beach with his back against that litter basket.
His suit coat?
Never found, Dave said. The tie, neither. But of course, if a man takes off his tie, 9 times out of 10 he'll stuff it into the pocket of his suit coat. I'd be willing to bet that if that gray suit coat ever did turn up, the tie'd be in the pocket. He was at his office drawing board by 8:35 a.m., Vince said, working on a newspaper ad for King Supers.
What?
Supermarket chain, dear, Dave said. Round 10:15, Vince went on, Judge the artist, be he Rankin or Franklin, saw our boy, the kid, heading for the elevators. Cogan said he was going around the corner to grab what he called a real coffee at Starbucks and an egg salad sandwich for lunch because he planned to eat at his desk. He asked Judge if Judge wanted anything.
This is all what Arla told you when you were driving her out to Tinoch?
Yes, ma'am. Taking her to speak with Cathcart. Make a formal identification of the photo. This is my husband, this is James Cogan, and then sign an exhumation order. He was waiting for us.
All right, sorry to interrupt. Go on.
Don't be sorry for asking questions, Stephanie. Asking questions is what reporters do. In any case, Judge the artist, be he Rankin or Franklin, Dave put in helpfully. Yeah, him. He told Cogan that he'd pass on the coffee, but he walked out to the elevator lobby with Cogan so they could talk a little bit about an upcoming retirement party for a fella named Haverty, one of the agency's founders. The party was scheduled for mid-May, and Judge the artist told Alla that her mister seemed excited and looking forward to it. They batted around ideas for a retirement gift until the elevator came, and then Cogan got on and told Judge the artist they ought to talk about it some more at lunch and ask someone else, some woman they worked with, what she thought. Judge the artist agreed that was a pretty good idea. Cogan gave him a little wave, the elevator doors slid closed, and that's the last person who can remember seeing the Colorado Kid when he was still in Colorado.
George the artist, she almost marveled. Do you suppose any of this would have happened if George had said, oh, wait a minute, I'll just pull on my coat and go around the corner with you?
No way of telling, Vince said.
Was he wearing his coat, she asked, Cogan? Was he wearing his gray overcoat when he went out?
Alla asked, but Judge the artist didn't remember, Vince said. The best he could do was say he didn't think so. And that's probably right. The Starbucks and the sandwich shop were side by side, and they really were right around the corner. She also said there was a receptionist, Dave put in, but the receptionist didn't see the men go out to the elevators. Said she must have been away from her desk for a minute.
He shook his head disapprovingly.
It's never that way in the mystery novels.
But Stephanie's mind had seized on something else, and it occurred to her that she had been picking at crumbs while there was a roast sitting on the table. She held up the forefinger of her left hand beside her left cheek. George the artist waves goodbye to Cogan, to the Colorado Kid, around 10:15 in the morning. Or maybe it's more like 10:20 by the time the elevator actually comes and he gets on.
Yeah?
Vince said. He was looking at her, bright-eyed. They both were. Now Stephanie held up the forefinger of her right hand beside her right cheek. And the counter girl at Jan's wharfside across the reach in Tinnock said he ate his fish and chips basket at a table looking out over the water at around 5:30 in the afternoon.
Vince said again.
What's the time difference between Maine and Colorado, an hour?
2,
Dave said. 2, she said, and paused and said it again. 2. So when George the artist saw him for the last time, when those elevator doors slid shut, it was already past noon in Maine.
Assuming the times are right, Dave agreed. And assumes all we can do, isn't it?
Would it work? She asked them. Could he possibly have gotten here in that length of time?
Yes, Vince said. No, Dave said. Maybe, they said together.
And Stephanie sat looking from one to the other, bewildered, her coffee cup forgotten in her hand. XVI.
That's what makes this wrong for a newspaper like the Globe, Vince said after a little pause to sip his milky coffee and collect his thoughts. Even if we wanted to give it up. Which we don't, Dave put in, and rather testily. Which we don't, Vince agreed. But if we did, Steffi, when a big city newspaper like the Globe or the New York Times does a feature story or a feature series, they want to be able to provide answers, or at least suggest them. And do I have a problem with that? The hell I do. Pick up any big city paper. What do you find on the front page? Questions disguised as news stories. Where is Osama bin Laden? We don't know. What's the president doing in the Middle East? We don't know, because he don't. Is the economy going to get stronger or go in a tank? Experts differ. Our eggs, good for you or bad for you, depends on which study you read. You can't even get the weather forecasters to tell you if a nor'easter is going to come in from the nor'east because they get burned on the last one. So if they do a feature story on better housing for minorities, they want to be able to say if you do A, B, C, and D, things will be better by the year 2030. And if they do a feature story on unexplained mysteries, Dave said, they want to be able to tell you the coastlights were reflections on the clouds, and the church picnic poisonings were probably the work of a jilted Methodist secretary. But trying to deal with this business of the time, which you happen to have put your finger on, Vince added with a smile. And of course, it's outrageous no matter how you think of it, Dave said. But I'm willing to be outrageous, Vince said. Hell, I looked into the matter, just about dialed the phone off the damn wall, and I guess I've right to be outrageous. My father used to say you can cut chalk all day, yet it won't never be cheese, Dave said, but he was also smiling a little. That's true, but let me whittle a little bit just the same, Vince said. Let's say the elevator does close at 10:20 Mountain Time, okay? Let's also say, just for the sake of argument, that this was all planned out in advance, that he had a car standing by with the motor running. All right, Stephanie said, watching him closely. Pure fantasy, Dave snorted, but he also looked interested.
It's far-fetched anyway, Vince agreed. But he was there at 10:15 at Jan's wharfside a little more than 5 hours later. That's also far-fetched. But we know it's a fact. Now may I continue?
Have on, Macduff, Dave said.
If he's got a car all warmed up and waiting for him, maybe he can make it to Stapleton in half an hour. Now, he surely didn't take a commercial flight. He could have paid cash for his ticket and used an alias, that was possible back then. But there were no direct flights from Denver to Bangor. From Denver to any place in Maine, actually.
You checked.
I did. Flying commercial, the best he could have done was arrive in Bangor at 6:45 p.m., which was long after that counter girl saw him. In fact, at that time of the year, that's after the last ferry of the day leaves for Moosie.
6 is the last? Stephanie asked.
Yep, right up until mid-May,
Dave said. So he must have flown charter, she said. A chartered jet? Are there companies that flew charter jets out of Denver, and could he have afforded one?
Yes, on all counts, Vince said. But it would have cost him a couple of $1,000, and their bank account would have shown that kind of hit.
It didn't? Vince shook his head. There were no significant withdrawals prior to the fellow's disappearance.
All the same, that's what he must have done. I checked with a number of different charter companies, and they all told me that on a good day, one when the jet stream was flowing strong and a little Lear like a 35 or a 55 got up in the middle of it, that trip would take just 3 hours, maybe a little more.
Denver to Bangor, she said.
Denver to Bangor. Yeah, there's no place closer to our part of the coast where one of those little burners can land. Not enough runway, don't you see?
She did. So did you check with the charter companies in Denver?
I tried. Not much joy there either, though. Of the 5 companies that flew jets of one size or another, only 2 had even talked to me. They didn't have to, did they? I was just a small-town newspaperman looking into an accidental death, not a cop investigating a crime. Also, one of them pointed out to me that it wasn't just a question of checking up on the FBOs that flew jets out of Stapleton.
What are FBOs?
Fixed base operators, Vince said. Chartering aircraft is only one of the things they do. They get clearances, maintain little terminals for passengers who are flying private so they can stay that way. They sell, service, and repair aircraft. You can go through U.S. Customs at lots of FBOs. Buy an altimeter if yours is busted, or catch 8 hours in the pilot's lounge if your current flying time is maxed out. Some FBOs, like Signature Air, are big business, chain operations, just like Holiday Inn or McDonald's. Others are seat-of-the-pants outfits, with not much more than a coin-op snack machine inside and a windsock by the runway.
You did some research, Stephanie said, impressed.
Yeah, enough to know that it isn't just Colorado pilots and Colorado planes that used Stapleton or any other Colorado airport. Then or now. For instance, a plane from an FBO at LaGuardia in New York might fly into Denver with passengers who were going to spend a month in Colorado visiting relatives. The pilots would then ask around for passengers who wanted to go back to New York, just so they wouldn't have to make the return empty.
These days, they'd have their return passengers all set up ahead of time by computer, Dave said. Do you see, Steph?
She did. She saw something else as well. So the records on Mr. Cogan's wild ride might be in the files of Air Eagle out of New York.
Air Eagle out of Montpelier, Vermont, Vince said.
Just Ducky Jets out of Washington, D.C., Dave said.
And if Cogan paid cash, Vince added, there are quite likely no records at all.
But surely there are all sorts of agencies.
Yes, ma'am, Dave said. More than you could shake a stick at, beginning with the FAA and ending with the IRS. Wouldn't be surprised if the damn FFA wasn't in there somewhere. But in cash deals, paperwork gets thin. Remember Helen Hafner?
Of course she did. That waitress at the Grey Gull, the one whose son had recently fallen out of his treehouse and broken his arm. She gets all of it, Vince had said of the money he meant to put in Helen Hafner's pocket. And what Uncle Sam don't know, don't bother him. To which Dave had added, it's the way America does business. Stephanie supposed it was, but it was an extremely troublesome way of doing business in a case like this one.
So you don't know, she said.
You tried your best, but you just don't know. Vince looked first surprised, then amused.
As to trying my best, Stephanie, I don't think a person ever knows that for sure. In fact, I think most of us are condemned, damned even, to thinking we could have done just a little smidge better, even when we went through to whatever it was we were trying to get. But you're wrong. I do know. He chatted a jet out of Stapleton. That's what happened.
But you said... He leaned even further forward over his clasped hands, his eyes fixed on hers.
Listen carefully, and take instruction, dear hat. It's long years since I read Sherlock Holmes, so I can't say this exactly, but at one point the great detective tells Dr. Watson something like this. When you eliminate the impossible, whatever is left, no matter how improbable, must be the answer. Now we know that the Colorado kid was in his Denver office building until 10:15 at 10:20 on that Wednesday morning, and we can be pretty sure he was in Jan's wife's site at 5:30. Hold up your fingers like you did before, Stephanie.
She did as he asked. Left forefinger for the kid in Colorado, right forefinger for James Cogan in Maine. Vince unlocked his hands and touched her right forefinger briefly with one of his own, age meeting youth in midair.
But don't call this finger 5:30, he said. We needn't trust the counter girl, who wasn't run off her feet the way she would have been in July, but who was doubtless busy all the same, it being the supper hour and all.
Stephanie nodded. In this part of the world, supper came early. Dinner, pronounced dinner, was what you ate from your lunch pail at noon, often while out in your lobster boat.
Let this finger be 6 o'clock, he said. The time of the last ferry.
She nodded again. Had to be on that one, didn't he?
He did, unless he swam the reach, Dave said.
Or chartered a boat, she said.
We asked, Dave said. More important, we asked Gad Edwick, who is the ferryman in the spring of 80.
Did Cogan bring him tea? She suddenly found herself wondering. Because if you want to ride the ferry, you're supposed to bring tea for the tiller man. You said so yourself, Dave. Or are the ferryman and the tiller man two different people?
Steph? Vince sounded concerned. Are you all right, dear?
I'm fine. Why?
You looked, I don't know, like you came over strange.
I sort of did. It's a strange story, isn't it? And then she said, only it's not a story at all. You were so right about that. And if I came over strange, I suppose that's why. It's like trying to ride a bike across a tightrope that isn't there. Stephanie hesitated, then decided to go on and make a complete fool of herself. Did Mr. Edwick remember Cogan because Cogan brought him something? Because he brought tea for the tiller man? For a moment, neither man said anything, just regarded her with their inscrutable eyes, so strangely young and sweetly lad-like in their old faces. And she thought she might laugh or cry or do something, break out somehow just to kill her anxiety and growing certainty that she had made a fool of herself.
Vince said, it was a chilly crossing. Someone, a man, brought a paper cup of coffee to the pilot house and handed it to Gad. They only passed a few words. This was April, remember, and by then it was already gone dark. The man said, smooth crossing. And Gad said, yeah. Then the man said, this has been a long time coming. Maybe I've been a long time coming. Gad said it might have even been Little's been a long time coming. There is such a name. There's none in the Tinnock phone book, but I found it in quite a few others.
Was Cogan wearing the green coat or the top coat?
Steph, Vince said. Gad not only didn't remember whether or not the man was wearing a coat, he probably couldn't have sworn in a court of law if the man was afoot or on horseback. It was getting dark, for one thing. It was one little act of kindness and a few past words recalled a year and a half downstream for a second. For a third, well, old Gad, you know.
He made a bottle-tipping gesture.
Speak no ill of the dead, but the man drank like a frickin' fish, Dave said. He lost the ferryman job in 85. The town put him on the plow, mostly so his family wouldn't starve. He had 5 kids, you know, and a wife with MS. But finally he cracked up the plow doing Main Street while Blotto put out all the frickin' power for a frickin' week in February, pardon my frickin' Francais, and he lost that job, so he was on the town. So am I surprised he didn't remember more? No, I am not. But I'm convinced, from what he did remember, that, the Colorado kid came over from the mainland on the day's last ferry, and, he brought tea for the tiller man. are a reasonable facsimile thereof. Good on you to remember about that, Steph.
He patted her hand. She smiled at him. It felt like a rather dazed smile.
As you said, Vince resumed, there's that two-hour time difference to factor in.
He moved her left finger closer to her right.
It's 12:15 East Coast time when Cogan leaves his office. He drops his easy-going just another day act the minute the elevator doors open on the lobby of his building, the very second. He goes dashing outside, hell-bent for election, where that fast car and an equally fast driver is waiting for him. Half an hour later, he's at a Stapleton FBO, and 5 minutes after that, he's mounting the steps of a private jet. He hasn't left this arrangement to chance, either. Can't have done. There are people who fly private on a fairly regular basis, then stay for a couple of weeks. The folks who take them one way spend those 2 weeks attending to other chatters. Our boy would have settled on one of those planes and almost certainly would have made a cash arrangement to fly back out with them, eastbound.
Stephanie said, what would he have done if the people using the plane he planned to take canceled their flight at the last minute? Dave shrugged.
Same thing he would have done if there was bad weather, I guess, he said. Put it off to another day.
Vince, meanwhile, had moved Stephanie's left finger a little further to the right.
Now it's getting close to 1 PM on the East Coast, he said. But at least our friend Cogan doesn't have to worry about a lot of security rigmarole, not back in 1980, especially not flying private. And we have to assume, again, that he doesn't have to wait in line with a lot of other planes for an active runway, because it screws up the timetable if he does, and all the while, on the other end, he touched her right finger, that ferry's waiting. Last one of the day. So, the flight lasts 3 hours. We'll say that anyway. My colleague here got on the internet. He loves that sucker with a passion. And he says the weather was good for flying that day. And the maps show that the jet stream was in approximately the right place. But as to how strong it was, that's information I've never been able to pin down, Dave said.
He glanced at Vince. Given the tenuousness of your case, partner, that's probably not a real bad thing.
We'll say 3 hours, Vince repeated, and moved Stephanie's left finger, the one she was coming to think of as her Colorado Kid finger, until it was less than 2 inches from her right one, which she now thought of as her James Cogan almost dead finger. It can't have been much longer than that.
Because the facts won't let it, she murmured, fascinated and in truth a little frightened by the idea. Once, while in high school, she had read a science fiction novel called The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. She didn't know about the moon, but she was coming to believe that was certainly true of time.
No, ma'am, they won't, he agreed. At 4 o'clock, or maybe 4:05, we'll say 4:05, Cogan lands and disembarks at Twin Cities Civil Air. That was the only FBO at Bangoa International Airport back then.
Any records of his arrival, she asked? Did you check? Knowing he had, of course he had. Also knowing it hadn't done any good one way or another. It was that kind of story. The kind that's like a sneeze which threatens but never quite arrives.
Vince smiled. Sure did. But in the carefree days before Homeland Security, all Twin City kept any length of time were their account books. They had a good many cash payments that day, including some pretty good-sized refueling tabs late in the afternoon, but even those might mean nothing. For all we know, whoever flew the kid in might have spent the night at a Bangoa hotel and flown out the next morning.
I spent the weekend, Dave said. Then again, the pilot might have left right away and without refueling at all.
How could he do that after coming all the way from Denver, Stephanie asked.
Could have hopped down to Portland, Dave said, and filled his tank up there.
Why would he? Dave smiled. It gave him a surprisingly foxy look that was not much like his usual expression of earnest and slightly stupid honesty. It occurred to Stephanie now that the intellect behind that chubby, rather childish face was probably as lean and quick as Vince Teague's.
Cogan might have paid Mr. Denver Flyboy to do it that way, because he was afraid of leaving a paper trail, Dave said.
and Mr. Denver Flyboy would very likely have gone along with any reasonable request if he was being paid enough.
As for the Colorado kid, Vince resumed, he's still got almost 2 hours to get to Tinnock, get a fish and chips basket at Jan's wharfside, sit at a table eating it while he looks out at the water, and then catch the last ferry to Moose Lookout Island.
As he spoke, he slowly brought Stephanie's left and right forefingers together until they touched. Stephanie watched, fascinated.
Could he do it?
Maybe, but it'd be awful goddamn tight, Dave said with a sigh. I'd have never believed it if he hadn't actually turned up dead on Hammock Beach. Would you, Vince?
Nope, Vince said, without even pausing to consider.
Dave said,
there's far dead airstrips within a dozen miles or so of Tinnock, all seasonal. They do most of their trade, taking up tourists on sightseeing rides in the summer. I have to look at the fall foliage when the colors peek out, although that only lasts a couple of weeks.
We checked him on the off chance that Cogan might have chartered him a second plane, this one a little prop job like a Piper Cobb, and flown from Bangor to the coast.
No joy there either, I take it.
You take it right,
Vince said, and his grin was gloomy rather than foxy.
Once those elevator doors slide closed on Cogan in that Denver office building, this whole business is nothing but shadows you can't quite catch hold of, and one dead body. Three of those far airstrips were deserted in April, shut right down, so a plane could have flown into any of them, and no one the wiser. The fourth one, a woman named Maisie Harrington lived out there with her father and about 60 mutt dogs, and she claimed that no one flew into their strip from October of 1979 to May of 1980. But she smelled like a distillery. I had my doubts if she could remember what went on a week before I talked to her, let alone a year and a half before.
What about the woman's father? She asked.
Stone blind and one-legged, Dave said. The diabetes.
Ouch, she said.
Let Jack and Maisie Harrington go hang, Vince said impatiently. I never believed in the second airplane theory when it comes to Cogan any more than I ever believed in the second gunman theory when it came to Kennedy. If Cogan had a car waiting for him in Denver, and I can't see any way around it, then he could have had one waiting for him at the General Aviation Terminal as well. And I believe he did.
That is just so far-fetched, Dave said.
He spoke not scoffingly, but dolefully.
Perhaps, Vince responded unperturbed, but when you get rid of the impossible, whatever's left, there's your pup scratching at the door to be let in.
He could have driven himself, Stephanie said thoughtfully.
Well, rental car? Dave shook his head. Don't think so, dear. Rental agencies take only credit cards, and credit cards leave paper trails.
Besides, Vince said, Cogan didn't know his way around eastern and coastal Maine. Suppose we can discover he'd never been here in his life. You know the roads by now, Steffi. There's only one main one that comes out this way from Bangor to Ellsworth. But once you get to Ellsworth, there's three or four different choices, and a flatlander, even one with a map, is apt to get confused. No, I think Dave is right. If the kid meant to go by car, and if he knew in advance how small his time window was going to be, he would have wanted to have a driver standing by and waiting. Somebody who'd take cash money, drive fast, and not get lost.
Stephanie thought for a little while. The two old men let her. Three hired drivers in all, she said at last. The one in the middle at the controls of a private jet.
Maybe with a co-pilot, Dave put in quietly. Them are the rules, at least.
It's very outlandish, she said. Vince nodded and sighed.
I don't disagree.
You've never turned up even one of these drivers, have you?
Nope.
She thought some more, this time with her head down and her normally smooth brow furrowed in a deep frown. Once more they did not interrupt her, and after perhaps 2 minutes she looked up again.
But why?
What could be so important for Cogan to go to such lengths? Vince Teague and Dave Bowie looked at each other, then back at her. Vince said,
"Ain't that a good question?"
Dave said,
"A rig of a question."
Vince said,
"The main question."
"Of course it is," Dave said. "Always was."
Vince, quite softly,
"We don't know, Stephanie. We never have."
Dave, more softly still,
"Boston Globe wouldn't like that.
Nope, not at all."